My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
It's good to be here, and don't ever do this, but I wanted to introduce our speaker tonight. I joined this club 10 years ago, right about 10 years ago, and one of the first things I remember somebody told me was, if you look around, the people that are pulling the wagon around here are usually doing better than the people that are riding in the wagon. And the speaker tonight is somebody that around Napa has been pulling the wagon for a long time. Some of you new people may not know, but there were a lot of good people for many years that said, we got to do something about the bathrooms here. People would leave and wouldn't go to the bathrooms here. Ladies wouldn't. And one day John said he wanted to start a committee. I worked on it with him, and it was amazing, the talent, the time, and his resources and his family's resources. He wouldn't want me to say too much about that, but it's amazing the commitment with his time, his finances, and everything that he contributed to this club, and we enjoy it today. And he serves on the board now with our president in the back, Brian, and it's just getting better and better. If you look around, there's so many good things going on here. He has served our country also. We wanted somebody on Memorial Day that had served our country. And I am proud to have a friend like John Thomas. He has made such a difference in my life and in this clubhouse. Of course, you're at home here, John, so come on up.
I don't know if can anybody follow something like that. And we're all in this together, folks. And without you, none of what Tim just said would have been possible in my life. And by the way, I'm John, and I'm an alcoholic. And those of you on my right side here are just going to have to put up with me maybe ignoring you a little bit if I forget to turn that way. But I'm really glad everybody's here tonight. And I'd like to start off by acknowledging what we all know. This is Memorial Day, when we remember those who have given their lives to protect our freedom and our rights in this country. Memorial Day is about the people who have laid down their lives. Veterans Day is about all the rest of us that may have not had to do that. So tonight, we're enjoying our right to assemble, and we are enjoying our right to speak freely because of the sacrifices that have been made for us. Without those two things, we couldn't be here tonight. AA could not exist without them. So we want to thank God for the sacrifice of all those who have laid down their lives so that we can be here tonight. My home group is the 11 a.m. Bridge Builders group here. And I want to thank Mike for chairing the meeting tonight. And I want to thank both Tims. Tim M. is here tonight for your very kind words, Tim. Right back at you. If you want to find a guy that's giving service around here, that's him back there. And also Tim R. Both Tims have really facilitated a wonderful thing here with this Monday night Blue Chip speaker meeting here. And it has become a mainstay of our life and opportunities here at the NAMA Club. I come from a long line of teetotalers. I have an interest, it happens, I have an interest in history and in genealogy, and I know my ancestors back to my great-grandparents and some before that. That's about maybe 18 or 20 people in all. They were all strong Presbyterians. And on the night that I took my first drink, I had already had more to drink than all of those people put together. When my lovely wife Marcy and I started dating 12 years ago, and she began to meet members of my wonderful family, she said, John, you don't have any black sheep in your family, do you? And y'all know what's coming now. I said, there is one. Who is that? Of course, it was me. So I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. My father was a preacher and a theology professor at a Presbyterian seminary. My mother was also a very highly educated woman and an accomplished musician. They were truly wonderful people. loved and admired, and they both gave great service in the world. I need to tell you, I was many years sober before I was able to accept and embrace that kind of charitable attitude towards them. But I was, thanks to AA, I had over 20 years of sober time with my father, and many more than that with my mother, who died in 2008 at the age of 103. So way back when I was in about the fourth or the fifth grade, mother found out that I'd been using some naughty language. So every day after that, when I got home from school, I would have to tell her if I had said any naughty words. So I got home one day and she said, "John, did you say any naughty words today?" I admitted I said one. Whereupon, mother made me tell her what I had said and proceeded to wash out my mouth with soap. At that time, I came to the conclusion that there was no benefit to telling the truth. So I stopped trying to do that. And as early as 8 or 9 years old, I was living two lives. The person I really was, which I kept secret and out of sight, and the person that I was not, which I put on for you to see on the outside. I got busted by my mother all the time. It seems that I never got by with anything. And she would turn me over to my father, who sometimes would administer the consequences with a leather razor strap. So I knew clearly what my parents' attitude toward was towards drinking, smoking, carousing, things like that. Any good Christian boy would resist those kinds of things. So thus, when the day came, finally, when I took my first drink at age 17, my senior year in high school, I felt guilty, ashamed, and really full of fear when I gave up and took a pull off of a friend of mine's beer. I went home drunk and sick that night. My priorities in life changed that night. My attitude and outlook changed. My primary purpose changed. Drinking became the number one force and purpose of my life, and everything else took second place. Family, my little sweet blonde girlfriend, Nancy, friends, ambitions in life, and most of the moral principles I still had left. I couldn't wait to graduate from high school, get to college, and be as far away from home as I could possibly get. So, with drinking and self-gratification as my primary purpose, it was amazing how fast I became an expert of both of those things. Within a year of the first drink, I was then 400 miles away from home at college in North Carolina, a little Presbyterian college named Davidson College. And I had progressed to the point where I drank just about every night. In my sophomore year, I dropped out of my fraternity boarding house so that I could take the $25 a month that my mother sent me to eat with and spend it buying beer at the local honky-tonk, which was known as the Anchor Grill. I literally ate Vienna sausages and saltine crackers in my dorm room every night so that I could pull this off. I got to know the Anchor's owner so well that he gave me a job two nights a week, part-time job, bartending for him. But I drank so much that I always went back to the dormitory owing him more than he owed me. So I was put on academic probation at the end of my sophomore year in the spring of 1960. I decided to drop out of college instead of going back to summer school so I could get reinstated. And I took a job working for the U.S. Forest Service out in the Idaho wilderness. It's pretty far away from Richmond. I stole a driver's license and a draft card Some of you younger folks may not know what a draft card is, but the older ones do. So that I would have ID to buy drinks when I was out in Idaho. 18 years later, I wrote that friend a Ninth Step amends letter, and he sent me one of the most forgiving and encouraging letters I've ever received. I had a few local drinking buddies that I met at the Anchor. And on the last day before leaving for Idaho, one of them was coming to pick me up at the Anchor, and we were going to drive to Charlotte for a going-away drinking bash. He was so drunk himself coming to pick me up that he ran his car off the road and was killed. We heard the sirens of the police cars and the ambulance from the Anchor. I had already had plenty to drink, and I remember just sitting there, drinking the rest of the day, and frankly having almost no thoughts about what had just happened. 6 months later, after I had returned home to Richmond from Idaho, and now I had a job driving a Coca-Cola truck, I met another drinking friend, and we arranged to meet at a local bar and get together for a wild evening. He never showed up. He was killed in a car accident on the way to meet me. The irony, the tragedy, and the warning of these two experiences escaped my conscious comprehension until after I'd been in AA for a number of years. I didn't go to either funeral. I don't recall having any thoughts about these guys very much for years after. I was emotionally and spiritually dead, and I was 20 years old. Driving a Coca-Cola truck was hard work with low pay, and I decided that it was incompatible with my need for much more money, much less work, more time to drink, and the image that I wanted other people to have of me. So I went back and finished college. I received an officer's commission in the U.S. Army, and I convinced my patient and long-suffering little blonde girlfriend, Nancy, to marry me. Then we spent 3 years on active duty in the Army as an aviator and later on a basic training company commander. We had two beautiful children during this time. In my drinking career, that Army time was the least affected by my drinking. But I had 10 more years of drinking to do after leaving the Army and bringing my family to Atlanta in 1966 to start my business career at one of the local banks. I was already living on borrowed time and escaping the just and reasonable consequences of my selfish, dangerous, addictive choices in life. Nancy and I bought a little brick three-bedroom bungalow in Clarkston with a VA loan and settled into our new life. It didn't take me long to find a new drinking buddy named Fred at the bank. Soon we were out every night after work drinking and carousing and scaring our wives to death, coming home at all hours of the night. We didn't care about them or our kids. We just wanted to party and have a good time. Fred was a little guy, brazen, pugnacious, and he liked to go down Auburn Avenue to the black folks' honky-tonks down there. Now, keep in mind, this was right in the middle of the Civil Rights Revolution. It scared me to death. But he got by with it, and all those wonderful black folks down there just loved him. One morning we woke up in a motel room with no recollection of what had happened the night before or where we'd been. That's the way life was for these two church-going professional men from the local bank. So, on another night, I had tickets to take my family to the Omni, which was downtown, and we had tickets to see the famous Russian gymnast Olga Korbut perform. Fred and I stayed out drinking too long, and I came home roaring drunk with very little time to make it back downtown to the show. Nancy did not want to put the Tards kids in the car with me, and she begged me to let her drive. I was having none of it. I herded them all into the car and sped off. They were terrorized by my driving. We arrived at our seats just in time for the performance to start, but I decided I needed a beer, so I made my oldest son, Jay, go to the concession stand with me to get a beer. And on the way back to our seats, I stumbled on the steps, fell down, spilled the beer all over the person who was sitting behind us, and my son Jay standing there watching. Many years later, after Nancy and I were divorced, but on really close and friendly terms as we still are today, she told me that Jay asked her one time when he was 7 or 8 years old, "Mom, how come Daddy never plays with me the way I see the other daddies playing with their kids?" And I can remember at home at night sitting on the sofa, and my beautiful daughter Beth would be sitting next to me. And this overwhelming urge would come over me to just reach out, put my arm around her, hug her, and tell her that I loved her. But I couldn't do it. I was frozen inside. Nancy would say, "John, please stop drinking." And I would say, I can stop drinking anytime I want to. I just don't want to. The day finally came when I did want to, and I could not do it. Meanwhile, my business career prospered. I was very good at bluffing my way through the necessary things in life. And I was recruited by a New York investment firm to set up a local Atlanta office. We bought a bigger house, had a third baby, and I became an officer of the church. I traveled a lot, and all my work associates were in New York. I became a loner, and I loved being on the road in other cities where I could drink and carouse away from anybody that knew me. Later, another investment company recruited me to an even better job. But this put me in a position of having to go downtown dressed up every day and report to an office. So things didn't work out as well at that company as they needed to. Now, my pattern of isolation and drinking were deeply established by this time. And the consequences of my behavior began to become more and more evident to the people that were working around me. And my job performance became progressively less satisfactory. I was a constant drunk driver. It never occurred to me that I could not handle a car drunk. I had years of close calls, but no arrests or accidents until my behavior finally began to catch up with me. I reached the point where I was a blackout, solitary, anonymous drinker seeking lower places and lower people. It would have been hard to find a people lower than me, by the way. One night I started out drinking at a bar near 10th and Peachtree Street, and I went into a blackout and came out of the blackout hours later at a bar down south of the airport. And I was sitting at a table with about 6 other people that I'd never met before. So they invited me to come to a house party, but I went into another blackout on the way to the house party. I woke up the next morning on the floor of this house wrapped in a blanket. The other people were not being as nice as they were the night before. And I hit the road out of there as fast as I could. But on the way out of the driveway, my car bumper caught on a chain link fence, and I dragged it halfway up the street before it dropped off. By some miracle, I made it to work that morning. But I was terrified the whole day that the cops would burst in, put me in handcuffs, and take me away. In January 1976, I received a call from my old friend Fred. Fred had moved away years before, and I hadn't seen him in years. He was coming to Atlanta on business and wanted to come by and see me. I was thrilled, and I had plenty of booze and beer ready at the house when he arrived. I offered him a drink, but He politely declined. I already had a head start and promptly proceeded to get myself another one. We sat down, and Fred told me the story of his drinking nightmare after he left Atlanta. He lost his business, almost lost his family, went bankrupt, and off to jail numerous times. But he looked different, happy, healthy, peaceful. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a green poker chip and said that he had received it at a place called Alcoholics Anonymous on his 9-month sobriety date. He said AA had helped him to stop drinking, and he just wanted to share his good news with me. He never said one word to me about me or my drinking. Then he said he needed to go, gave me a smile and a hug, and left. Years later, I found out that Fred drove to Atlanta that day just to see me. He did not have another appointment in town. Fred's carrying the message of recovery in AA to me saved my life. At first, though, I did everything I could to prove that I was not like Fred. I didn't need any help to stop drinking. But I did decide to control my drinking. I could stop any time I wanted to. I'll just control my drinking. I tried everything I could think of to do that. And I thought this up before I ever read the same stuff in the big book. I want you to know that. Drink only beer. Drink only liqueur. Let me tell you, that does not work. Drink only at night. Drink only on weekends. Drink only during the week. A lot of onlys in there. But the only I got was worse. About a month after Fred came to see me, I was out again, cruising and drinking around the seedy parts of Atlanta in my nice company car, and I went into a blackout and got lost. When I came to, I was curb bound on a side street that I'd never seen before, and I was trying to rock my car off the curb by gunning the accelerator and shifting back and forth between forward and reverse. No luck. I realized there was a police car behind me. He was about 100 feet behind me. The cop got out, came and put me in handcuffs, and put me in the cage in the back seat of his car. While we were waiting for the paddy wagon to come and get me, my car burst into flames and then exploded. All my rocking had superheated the metal undercarriage and caused this to happen, and if the cop had not been there, I would have died in that explosion. I spent that night in the old Grady lockup in the Atlanta City Jail drunk tank. But it wasn't enough. That was not enough for me. My boss then was CEO of the company. He should have fired me many times over, but confrontation was not his thing. And he just ignored my poor job performance, late arrivals, early departures, and very strange behaviors. I conjured up a cock and bull story about how my company car burned up. And he accepted it and told me to go out and order another one. So, the dealer tag was still on my brand new 1976 yellow Buick LeSabre with a tan vinyl top on the night of April the 27th, 1976, when after an evening of late work with the company auditors and then some even later drinking at a local bar, I ran a stop sign at 17th in Spring Street in a blackout, straight into the path of an oncoming taxi cab. The cab T-boned me on the driver's side and knocked me across the road against a telephone pole. One of the company auditors was in the shotgun seat with me, and there were 5 people in the taxi cab. Both cars were totaled, but we all 7 walked away unhurt. both doors on my car were smashed shut, so the other fellow that was with me and I, we had to wait to be pried out of that car. While I was trapped in my seat, and with all the commotion going on outside, I had the first moment of clarity that I have ever had up to that point about my drinking and my life. I said in my mind, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. I'm going to go to that AA place that my friend Fred told me about and ask them to help me stop drinking. That was 4 months after Fred had visited me. I was almost 36 years old, and I had been drinking for 18 and a half years. By God's grace and the help and love I have received from you and hundreds of other AAs over the past 37 years, I have not had another drink since that night. Thank God, and thank AA that all of my wonderful kids and all five of my wonderful grandkids and my wonderful former wife, Nancy, love me and respect me and want me in their lives today. What a gift. My youngest son, Phil, was 5 years old when I got sober. None of my grandkids has ever seen me drunk. I was fortunate to still have my job when I made it to AA. The job required a fair amount of travel, but I managed to stay off the road for the first 90 days that I was in AA. Traveling and being alone in another city was a major drinking trigger for me. But the day came when I had to go to Houston on business, and I was very nervous. So my sponsor, Hubert, and I researched AA meetings, and we found one that was near the motel where I was going to be staying. I checked into the motel and left in plenty of time to find that meeting. I was about 30 minutes early. The parking lot was empty, so I sat in my car, said the serenity prayer, and breathed deeply. There weren't any cell phones in those days to call your sponsor or one of your AA buddies. I went into the church and I couldn't find anybody. Returning to my car, I became very nervous and couldn't decide what I needed to do. I began to think about my home group. And at that moment, I would have given almost anything if just one of the people in my home group had been there that I could talk to. About that time, a car pulled up, and then another one, and then another, and folks began to go inside. So after a short time, I went in, I found where they were, and found out it was AA. They welcomed me happily and took care of me for the rest of the evening. In my haste to get to that meeting, I totally forgot that I had moved into the Central Time Zone. I was an hour and a half early for that meeting. This was one of the most valuable early experiences that I had in AA. I became vividly aware of the tremendous gift of AA to the suffering alcoholic, the gift of another understanding alcoholic to help each other stay sober. I realized that this was exactly what happened to Bill Wilson in the Mayflower Hotel in Akron in 1935. About a year and a half after I had come into AA, my life and my circumstances had come back together, and the wreckage and the consequences of my drinking were in the past. I told my sponsor, Hubert, that I really loved AA, but I was busy back at work and in my family, and I wouldn't have as much time to go to meetings anymore as I used to. You know, and everybody's first sponsor that we talk about in here was a philosopher and everything. You know, the greatest thing that ever happened. And my sponsor, Hubert, was the greatest thing that happened to me in early AA. And he was one of these guys that would always think before he said something. And so he scratched his head and he said, John, AA literature does not say that our program is our only purpose. It says it's our primary purpose. Many other good purposes can be an outgrowth of that, but that's the foundation of who we are once we get sober in AA. I had to learn that lesson again after many years of sobriety. After about 12 years in AA, I went several years without coming to a meeting. I developed a serious and dangerous dry drunk. I came to understand that if I can't even remember when the last AA meeting I went to, I'm no longer a member of AA. The consequences to me were that when I came to the point where I had lapsed away from AA meetings and relationships, I did not have the spiritual resources to avoid falling back into almost all of my character defects. I am grateful that I returned to AA without drinking, but I cannot say that AA principles were anywhere evident in my life at that time. I did not drink, but I sure did stink. After that long dry drunk, I returned to AA with a lot more passion and commitment to the fellowship and to our wonderful 12-step program of recovery. In my first year of AA, I had honestly worked through the 12 steps with my sponsor, Hubert. I had been fully grounded in the surrender of step one. I had received tremendous benefit from the inventory steps 4 and 5, and also the amend steps 8 and 9. However, I can see now that for years before that lapse happened, I had been paying less and less attention to practicing the principles, and that I had slipped into a sobriety that was based mostly on personal relationships and fellowship, which I even lost them when I lapsed away from my meetings. I was practicing personalities over principles, rather than principles over personalities, as suggested in AA's 12th tradition about anonymity. I had forgotten the line in the big book which says, "We are given a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition." I did have a God of my understanding, but as described in our AA book, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, I had turned him into a bush league pinch hitter. I failed to place God first in my life. About a year after I returned to AA, I was asked to lead a meeting on Step 6, which says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I studied and prepared and began to give my discussion comments in the meeting. While I was sharing about all the work I had done to get over my character defects, it finally came to me that steps 6 and 7 are not about my character defects or any work I can do to get over them. They are about reconnecting me with the spiritual attitudes of step 1, 2, and 3. And this attitude is well expressed, as we all know, in AA's 3 pertinent ideas at the end of a reading on how it works. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That God could and would if He were so. Sometimes we shorten that up even more with one of our favorite slogans, "Let go and let God." When I was drinking, my primary purpose was to drink and to fulfill my own selfish and self-centered desires for myself. What materialized for me and my family from that behavior was chaos, heartbreak, anger, alienation, misery. As an active member of AA whose primary purpose is to stay sober and help others, what materializes for me is peace, serenity, contentment, happiness, loving relationships. Thanks to AA, and thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks to AA, I am now living the happiest years of my life. I have a loving God that I have learned to put first in all things. I have sobriety. I have the steps. I have a wonderful wife, Marcy, who supports me in my AA life. I have a loving family. I have wonderful friends in AA, including special people who share with me on a very deep and personal level. As my sponsor, Hubert, said all those many years ago, I know my primary purpose. So, may the God of your understanding bless each of you as you continue in your recovery. And I appreciate very much the opportunity to share with you here tonight.
On that broad highway.